This is Spectrum.
Alternative Medicine. Homeopathy. Secret Society. Hypnosis. The Paranormal. Alternative Energy. UFO. Abduction. The Weird. The Wild. And the Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing this week?
Yeah, hi, Scott. I'm good.
Awesome.
How you doing?
Life is good. Life is good. We got a guest with us, going to be talking about reincarnation. Tell us a little bit about him.
Certainly could. We have Stephen Sakellarios, who is a video and audio archivist, producer, and editor, living in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. He has a master's degree in counseling and human systems from Florida State University. He began a serious interest in fine art photography in 1986 and moved into video production in 1990 as an extension of his photography. He started a video production company called Gold Thread Video in 1997. And shortly thereafter, he began work in another life, reincarnation in America, as a personal project. In Another Life was broadcast by Denver PBS affiliate KBDI in January 11th of 2003 and has been accepted for distribution by Films Media Group, the oldest and largest company selling to universities and libraries. Stephen was also interviewed by Shirley MacLaine for her internet radio show, Independent Expression. So let's welcome Stephen. How are you doing, Stephen?
Great. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
Hey, Stephen. How you doing?
Hey, good.
I think what I'd like to start with is the beginning of this. The DVD, and it's all over the internet, In Another Life, Reincarnation in America. If you guys want to see it, it's, you just type it into Google, it'll pop up. Is what got you interested in that first? What led you down the path of wanting to find out more about this?
Well, I had started studying Eastern philosophy and mysticism way back when I was about 19, and I had become a follower of Meher Baba about age 20, 1974, and had gone on, and I just accepted reincarnation as part of what I was reading, as part of the Bhagavad Gita and other scriptures that I read. It was natural to me. But then when I started my company, a little video production company in 1997, I had been doing photography as a creative person. I'm really an artist more than a businessman. And I didn't want my creative work to just stop because I was in business. I'd seen people that did that, you know, and they didn't do anything creative after they went into business. I didn't want to be like that. So I vowed to myself I was going to have a creative project. Had no idea what it would be. But round about that time, I started talking to people who started telling me their paranormal experiences. And no matter who I talked to, somebody, somewhere in their family, they had a paranormal experience. I was thinking to myself, this is all over the place. Everybody's having these experiences, but nobody's talking about them, you know. So the last straw was I was in my office early in the morning, and this old fella, World War II vet, who was cleaning the offices, came, and he started telling me all his war stories. And he went on and on and on, and I didn't have the heart to stop him. And finally, he ran out of steam, and he looked at me like, okay, I think I can trust this guy. And this old crusty bird starts telling me about how he was sitting on the back porch looking over a field at night, and his mother appeared to him out in the field, and that very moment she had died. He didn't know. So I said, okay, you know, if this guy has a paranormal experience, everybody has got one, and everybody needs to know that everybody else is having one, you know. So a lot of these people had told me reincarnation stories, past life memory experiences, and so I had this all in my mind, and one morning I woke up, and I just knew that I was going to do a documentary about reincarnation. It had been decided in my sleep somehow. I don't know how. So that's how I got started on it.
Okay. And then the process of it is you went in face-to-face, interviewed people for the documentary, for the DVD. And what was that like? I mean, that must have been a process, contacting people, setting up times, you know, traveling around, having to meet them up, film them. That's a pretty big process, especially if you don't have a big budget. You didn't have like a $10 million budget, I suppose.
I had no budget. I had over 5 years, I had $1,300 donated, and I was poor. So what I did was, this is 1997 when the Internet is just starting. You know, people are just starting to really use it, and lots of people don't know how to use it. So I realized it was very intuitive, that this is the way my mind worked, you know, was to network. And I started using the Internet to network before basically very many people were doing that. And it was very intuitive. Somebody would happen to mention somebody who would happen to say, have you heard of Carol Bowman? Oh, here's their website, and so on. So in the middle of all that, I got a call from a fellow named Jeff Keane, who was up in Trumbull, Connecticut, who said, this is an assistant fire chief up in Trumbull. And he said, the second time I've ever used the Internet at the station, I came across your website, which was very difficult back then because I just started it. And he said, my past life was there where you are in Atlanta. And we began talking, and a whole series of coincidences happened as a result of that. So it was a great deal of synchronicity, meaningful coincidences. And what I learned was, is the closer you get to a past life, the more synchronicity starts to occur.
Yeah. Well, what were the synchronicities?
Well, I mean, they're unbelievable. I actually had them as part of my documentary's anecdotes page. When you send out a press kit, you're supposed to have anecdotes about the film. And I created one with these synchronicities, and like nobody would ever write me back after I sent them this page. Okay, so Jeff called, right? And he's going to come down, and I'm going to interview him. And so I wanted to have some psychics read him without ever knowing anything about him on film live. And people didn't do that back then. This is before the days of John Edwards or anybody. Basically, this was groundbreaking. So I called the Edgar Cayce Foundation, and they gave me 3 psychic referrals. And one of them was for a psychic school in the Blue Ridge Mountains. I've forgotten the name of it now. And I called, and I was trying to get the head of that school, who had been connected with Arthur Ford, to do one of these readings, and I couldn't ever get through to her. But in the meantime, I kept talking to the same fellow, Steve Smith, who was answering the phone. And we had some, he was interested in electronic music, and we had some technical things, interests in common, and we talked. And finally, after the third or fourth call, he says, by the way, what is this referring to? And not thinking, really speaking, I shouldn't have said anything, but I told him. I said, it has to do with Jeff Keane, who believes that he was John B. Gordon in a previous life. And Steve Smith says, oh, John B. Gordon was my great-great-uncle. So it went on from there. There was a whole bunch of coincidences.
Whoa.
Like that, yeah. That was just one.
So you were talking to the guy who happened to have that gentleman has his great aunt. That's a wild coincidence.
Right. I brought them together at the State Capitol building where John B. Gordon had later on been the governor of Georgia, and I brought them together there, and we walked around for an hour, and I filmed them. At the end of that hour, Steve Smith says, it's been an honor to meet one of my ancestors, you know. And he was a psychic. He was in that psychic school. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Wow. So what were some of the other adventures you had while filming?
Well, one of the most amazing ones was that I learned about Roger Wolger, who is a past life therapist par excellence. He uses the Netherton method, which means he doesn't hypnotize people. He uses association, and really a genius in my estimation. He's a bit better known now, but I managed to get in touch with him, and I managed to get him to agree to let me film. But the condition of filming was that I go through a week-long workshop. This is up in Alexandria, Virginia, so in that area. So I did that. I went through the whole program, and I have a master's in counseling, so I was just barely qualified to go ahead and regress people and be regressed. And when he needed a volunteer, I immediately threw up my hand before anybody else, so I was regressed by him, and then was able to videotape one session and a nice long interview with him.
Okay. Wow. So what other sort of things happened? You interviewed so many people, and I hope you didn't have to do week-long training courses for all of them.
No. That was the only one. When I filmed Jeff Keane, I also went up to film him at the Antietam Battlegrounds in Maryland. And while I was there, I was going to be interviewing Carol Bowman, who is now quite well-known. She wasn't so much then, but her interest is in children talking about their past lives. And while I was at the museum in the Antietam Battlefield, they have a little, you know, museum area there. I was looking at a picture of a man and some other swords and things, and I heard this little boy behind me says, "I know that man." I turned around. He's about 10 feet away from me, behind me. He comes rushing up next to me, looks at this picture, and he says, "I know that man." And I said, "Well, who is it?" And he says, "That's John." Well, it was, I forget the guy's name now, but it was John somebody. He was a Union officer. And I said, "What did he do?" And he says, "He killed all the bad guys." And then his parents come in behind him, and I say, "Can he read?" And the mother says, "I don't know. I don't think he could read that." And the father shook his head and said, "No, he can't. He couldn't read that." And he looked like the guy. So that was another one of the coincidences. But right before I go talk to Carol Bowman, this actually happens right in front of my eyes.
Wow. So a lot of major coincidences.
Sorry, Scott. I want to ask the birthmarks that most of us have. What's the connection to past life and reincarnation?
Well, Dr. Ian Stevenson documented this. He's a psychiatrist and, of course, an MD. And what he found was is when you, many times or certain percentage of times, I don't know what the percentage is, the children who remember a past life and it checks out historically, they find that, some 20 or 30 statements that the child has made check out for their past life. Some of these have scars that seem to correspond with injuries that they had usually when they died in the previous life. So if the fellow was shot, say, in the, shot in the head, you have a little scar that corresponds to an entrance wound and a bigger scar in the back that corresponds to an exit wound, or there's one guy, they have a picture of a guy who has a birthmark on his chest, all kind of splotchy, spots all over his chest like a scars. And then, he talked about a past life. They verified that that was a past life. And in the past life, the guy was shot with a shotgun in the chest. In the autopsy report has a picture that shows the same basic pattern, So he documented that, but he didn't really try to explain it.
Do we have an explanation of what birthmarks are? This normal? Like, why do we have those things in the first place?
Well, my explanation is that when the baby is being formed in the uterus, that the incoming mind and the impressions in the incoming mind, working through what's called the subtle body or the energy body, directs the growth of that infant. And if there's impressions, strong impressions of an injury, then those impressions also get imprinted on the new body.
Well, that's as good an explanation as I've heard. Yeah, totally works.
So what it means is that genetics is not simply physical, that there's also a mental component to genetic transmission.
Yeah, because, majority of us have them, and it's so, they're most of them are weird looking, and there's really no reasoning for them to be where they are.
Well, according to this, a certain percentage of them are actually meaningful. If you could see your past lives, you'd see the connection.
I remember on the DVD, one of the gentlemen saying that there's a reason you don't remember your past lives, at least consciously, and one of those reasons was that it would just be too overwhelming, that there's a wall between the subtle body and the mental body that protects you, because if you had that information of all those lives, as some of them being contradictory to this life, a completely different character, a completely different outlook on life, that it could be, psychologically dangerous. What's your opinion on that?
I agree with that. I think partly it depends on how much evolved a person is, that as they get more evolved, they're able to integrate more of these different facets of their personality, and each facet represents a lifetime or several lifetimes. So eventually you get to where you can integrate more of these things, but people who aren't quite so evolved would be really thrown off by it.
I look at it like a template. When a child is 3, 4, 5 years old, they don't have an extensive personality template. They don't have an extensive outlook template already built up in their outlook on life. So they can access the other lives easier. Whereas if you're like 50 or something, you've got a whole life of built up, programming or outlook on life, and it's difficult at that point.
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, up to about age 7, most children seem to remember a past life, but they clam up if they're not respected, you know, listened to respectfully, so you wouldn't think so. But up to about age 7, I think most children are really operating on their previous life more than their current one.
Yeah, because that's the template that they can access at that point. And then as they get older, of course, they overlay new thoughts, ideas, and outlooks. And that basically builds the wall in a way.
It builds a wall, but not so much emotionally. And
okay.
later on we get into my book, we'll see that I was able to access the emotions from the past life quite readily. It was the actual intellectual memories that I had a lot of trouble with.
Okay, go ahead. Tell me about that. Let's jump into that. Tell me how that works.
Well, in my particular case, I found out about the past life match without being psychic, without really having a great number of past life flashbacks or experiences. I just kind of stumbled on it, and I knew it was correct. When I looked at the picture of my past life person, I knew that was me, so I had the match, but I couldn't seem to remember anything. And the harder I looked at the history and the harder I tried to remember, the more the emotions came through, but not the memory. So it was, you know, his personality and his feelings and everything else would start bleeding through, and I still wouldn't be able to recognize things that he obviously should have been able to recognize. So I questioned it at first until I really understood what was going on.
Right, and this has to do with a new book you've written called Matthew Franklin Whittaker in His Own Words.
Yeah, Whittier, yeah.
Whittier, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And that has to do with the book. And what was the process there? Was that a long, drawn-out process, or did it come in, like, blocks of information?
Well, I just kind of dabbled in the research for the first couple years. I would, you know, I managed to find a dissertation on him. And his brother was famous, although very little mention is made of Matthew. His brother, John Greenleaf, was famous as a poet. So there was references to him here and a little reference to him there, and it didn't seem very accurate to me, but I couldn't really prove it because, well, I kind of liken it to Jimmy Carter and his brother Billy Carter.
Right.
If you guys remember that, I'm old enough to remember that. But Billy Carter was sort of a ne'er-do-well, you know. he had a brand of beer or something, you know. Yeah, well, Matthew Franklin Whittier is portrayed rather that way in relationship to his brother.
Right. And did you have emotional feelings when you were reading that? Did you,
yeah, I was outraged.
Like, get pissed off? Or
very much. Outraged, yeah. And so I started, I would look at pictures of the family homestead and things like that, and I wouldn't recognize it. And I was thinking, oh, man, surely if I'm him, I would recognize where I grew up, you know. But what I realized was it's all tied to emotions. So if there's something that I felt strongly about emotionally, that would ring a bell, you know. But not anything that I just, you know, just happened to be around. I would be looking right at it and wouldn't remember it.
Right. You may not remember the house you lived in, but you would remember when your brother said something and pissed you off.
Exactly, yeah. Or if something, you know, traumatic happened at some corner of the house, you'd remember that corner of the house. In this particular case, the only thing I remembered, recognized about the picture was the stone wall. And my feeling is pride. That's a really good stone wall, and I did it, and I was really good at it, you know. And I know nothing about stonemasonry today, but I know that's a good job. that's it. And the other thing I found is if you had a negative feeling, the tendency is to feel nothing at all, at least in my case. It's
okay.
Like it's out. So I began using my emotions as the compass as opposed to intellectual memories. I did some couple past life regressions, and I did have a couple psychic readings, which I add in. So I went on like that, kind of dabbling in it for maybe a couple years. And then at this time in my life, I was on the dating website, and I happened to like a particular movie. I put my favorite movie down as Local Hero. And this person from Newburyport in Amesbury area wrote me that that was also their favorite movie. And I didn't have any idea where Newburyport was. And we got to corresponding a little bit and just became friends. It wasn't a romantic connection, but turns out Newburyport, Amesbury, Haverhill is where Matthew grew up. So she lived smack where he grew up. and I had no idea. So I began sharing this, and gradually that person became a researcher, volunteer researcher for me. And
yet another synchronicity.
Yeah, very much so. And that's when it really kicked in gear. As a matter of fact, this person had been thinking about, well, I won't say that. I'm trying to keep their identity, you know, so that they don't get in, you know, any kind of hot water or anything from prejudice. So I have to try to be careful about not revealing who they are.
That's fine.
But anyway, then I started emailing back and forth with this person. They would send me pictures or some historical bit of information, and then I would try to react to it. You know, how do I feel about this? Do I feel this is accurate? Do I feel it's not accurate? And we went on from there, kind of building clues, and I would keep a careful note of, I mean, all this is an email, so it's all dated. So I know when I reacted to something, and I would really stick my neck out. I wasn't worried about whether it was right or wrong, or I would look foolish or anything. I'd stick my neck way out and say, whatever I felt, I would say. You know, I feel like this is wrong. I feel like this is right. So one of the most interesting examples to me was I felt a strong connection with Matthew Franklin Whittier's first wife, Abby. Abby DePoyen was her maiden name. And she's mentioned just a few times in the history, but she's mentioned it's either spelled A-B-B-Y or A-B-B-I-E. Either way, it's about 50-50. And when I saw I-E, the A-B-B-I-E, I would feel very annoyed. I say, that's not right. You know, I don't think that's right. It's Y, you know, and it really bothers me when it's I-E. And I said that two or three times, and I've got those emails, and one of them's in the book. You know, I put this in the book with the date. Then I've got the date that my researcher found a letter that was written by Abby that has her signature that shows that it's Y, you know. So that's a 50-50 chance if you want to look at it from a cynical point of view. But I had the emotion behind it. I said, this is really pissing me off. It's not IE, you know, and I've got that dated. So that's just one small example of the way this research went. I've got everything dated as to when I expressed my emotional reaction and when we got the evidence that either proves or disproves it or shows that it either was possible or not possible.
And did this research correspond with the DVD and all the interviews, or was it previous to or after?
I didn't find out about Matthew Franklin Whittier until well after the documentary was produced.
Oh, that's interesting. So you'd already had all of these people that were reporting on or talking about the reincarnation, and then later on you developed your own story or unraveled your own past life story. That's very interesting.
The seeds of it goes back a ways. I can't remember whether it's before the documentary or after, to be perfectly honest, but I had a psychic reading, and the psychic told me you were a woman writer on the West Coast fairly recently, and you did serials, meaning, you know, like each week, you know, a new installment, and you had some success with that. So in the back of my mind, I was always thinking it'd be really nice if I could find that. So I was, every once in a while, I'd poke around on the Internet and look at the names of women writers to see if anything rang a bell. And then, you know, a few things seemed a little familiar, and then I said, that's my imagination, I don't know. Then finally I hit one, and it was Sarah Orne Jewett. And I said, I know that name, definitely. You know, that's very strong, because recognition memory survives even when all other types of memory are gone. So it's, other than emotions, it's like the most basic kind of memory. So I recognized that name. And I looked her up. There's a Sarah Orne Jewett text project website. And I looked on there and I said, well, it wasn't me. You know, I wasn't this person. She lived in a grand house. She was, you know, a Boston socialite and so on. But she was part of the Romantic writers. So she's the wrong era and she's the wrong coast for what I was looking for. But I know the name. So I wrote to Jeff Keane. So this was after the documentary. So I wrote to Jeff Keane. And because he had all the synchronicity about him, I said, if anybody can find what this is about, Jeff can find it. So I wrote to him and I said, I feel like I'm close, but I can't find what it is. So he looks at this and he finds kind of a difficult to find page in that website that has all her social circle, all the people that she was connected with. And way down at the bottom is Matthew Franklin Whittier. You click on it and you'll see his image. So Jeff, within a half hour, I think it was, he sent me back the link, and he says, this looks like you. What do you think about this one? As soon as I saw that and looked at the eyes, it looks about, I would say, 85% like me. There's a comparison photo in the book and in the flyer I've made. But I looked at that, and I looked at the eyes, and I knew. You know, that's me. So that's how I got started. But I wasn't looking, and the guy is so much like me. I mean, my talents, my you know, my mind, my sense of humor, my problems, my, you know, the things that I've been through in life, everything is parallel with this guy. I understand him as well as I understand myself, you know.
Wow.
But I wasn't looking for that. You know, I wasn't looking for somebody that matched me. I wasn't even looking for a man. You know, I was looking for a woman writer. You know, so it's completely a coincidence that this guy has anything in common with me at all.
Okay. Wow, that's a great story. Tom, do you have a question?
Very interesting. Yeah, I was wondering what, if you can tell us a little bit about the connection between reincarnation and near-death experiences.
Well, you know, a near-death experience means that you come back into the same body, and reincarnation means you come back in another body. So in a nutshell, that would be it. In other words, you don't go through the whole process in a near-death experience. You leave your body. You're in your astral body at that point, or some call it a subtle body, but you're connected with what they call a silver cord, like like an umbilical cord. And as long as that cord is not severed, you're still alive, really speaking. And this happens every night when people sleep. They go out of their bodies in this astral body, just don't remember it. So a near-death experience is like a conscious waking dream, in a sense. But then you go back into your body, and many, many people report that they didn't want to go back in, that it was like a, you know, a thing that they didn't want to, it was painful. They were, to go back in, it was painful, in other words, because they were free of pain, and they were, you know, happy. But they were told, often people are told in near-death experiences, you're not finished, there's more that you need to do, you need to go back, and they don't want to go back, you know. So, but in a near-death experience, they go back, and it's quite life-changing because their whole perspective changes. But in reincarnation, you know, you're out of your body, the silver cord is severed, you can't go back, and then you go on to the astral plane or the Bardo realm, some in Tibetan Buddhism, and you spend a certain amount of time there, and most people spend that time kind of mulling over and hashing over what happened in their last lifetime. But some people become aware of the environment and interact with other people, and there's, you know, there's ways to learn and there's ways to develop your talents and so on. And then at some point they get drawn back, and they may have some part in planning the life that they're coming into, or sometimes people just can get sucked into it, I think, or like a vacuum. And then you forget. Normally people go through, it's been called the river of forgetfulness or the drink of forgetfulness. But anyway, they normally speaking, you forget once you come back into a body. And the soul usually, the astral body usually comes in and really gets itself established in the new body in the womb around 5 months, around the time of quickening, although there's exceptions to that. And then you're born, and, you know, for the first 7 years, you still remember things, but if you dare to mention it to parents that don't believe in reincarnation, then they say that's silly. You don't ever talk about it again. And then after about 7 years, you forget. So that's pretty much the breakdown of NDEs versus reincarnation.
In reincarnation, we go through enough times in order to learn whatever lessons. Am I correct?
Yes. Well, you have to kind of think of lessons a little bit differently than what we would think of. School is a good analogy, but this is really learning wisdom more than just didactic. Right. Knowledge, you know, intellectual knowledge. This is learning wisdom, gaining wisdom, and wisdom means gaining character, strength of character. And there's a lot of different facets to that. So what happens is you can't take all the courses all at once. So if you want to learn, I always fall back on this example, but if you want to learn strength at the beginning of that lesson, strength 101, you're not going to get kindness very easily. See, I mean, it's hard to get both. So you learn strength, but you're not very kind. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, Roman soldier or whatever. So then you create a mess for yourself that way. There's repercussions from that. And in the process of experiencing those repercussions, at some point you swing like a pendulum back to the other extreme and say, the heck with strength. I want to be kind and gentle and compassionate. So now you have somebody who's gentle as a lamb, who's very compassionate and very kind, but they don't really worry about whether they're strong or not. See, and there's repercussions from that too,
because you could be taken advantage of at that point.
you can be taken advantage of, you can not be able to protect your family, you know, things like that. So then you come back and say, next time I'm going to, you know, be a wrestler, I'm going to take judo, I'm going to be a karate expert, and I'm going to protect my family, and I'm totally into this, you know, and you're not very kind again. So it goes back and forth and back and forth, but gradually you learn, I can be strong and kind at the same time. And then you've got that lesson. Okay, now you've come to a transcendent understanding of the two opposite things in that class. So you've got strength / weakness, you know, you've got that class now. So now you have to move into something else, which might be, you know, mind and heart, or I don't know. You know, there's a million of these things. So, you know, say asceticism versus indulgence, you know, for example. So you've got to work with those opposites. And there's a long process. So we're talking a long course of incarnations.
That's interesting. You mentioned a little bit about life between life. I wanted to know if you got any reports or any of the people talked about this to you, or did you get any information about the more detailed information about the life between life, other than just, you know, reflecting on your past life?
I can't remember that any of my interviewees ever went into it. I could be wrong. I'm just searching my memory now. I don't think there's too much about that. I really wasn't focusing too much on it in my questioning, so therefore I didn't, elicit very much about that.
Right, right. I would think that would be an interesting stage to learn more about. Tom, you did have a question. Go ahead.
I was going to say, eventually when we reach this final point of learning whatever we're supposed to learn, what occurs at that point? Where do we go?
Well, of course, I don't know about this directly, so I have to go to what I've read. And when you read other people's explanations of these things, you want to try to get the people that you feel like know the most about it. So when I started studying these things back in when I was 19 or 20, I picked two or three or four that I felt had achieved the greatest spiritual realization, and then went with them. And as I've mentioned, I became a follower of Meher Baba, and I also studied Sri Ramakrishna and Rumi and some other teachers, and put together what I understand of that. But this is beyond my, you know, beyond my personal experience completely. But supposedly what happens is that you begin to experience the inner planes of consciousness, which are more and more refined, higher and higher rates of vibration. And you continue to incarnate, but when you incarnate and you're stationed on one of these inner planes, you experience from that perspective. You don't actually experience what a normal physical conscious person would experience. And eventually you move to a consciousness of what they call God realization, self-realization, nirvikalpa samadhi. It's called by a lot of different names, and they say you really can't describe it, although they try to describe it. It's a complete experience of oneness, where you've moved beyond the physical, you've moved beyond the realm of energy, you've moved beyond the realm of the mind, and it's just pure existence. And you don't reincarnate anymore from that.
I'd be interested to know if any of the people that you've interviewed have talked about a life that existed somewhere other than Earth, because this is my thing with the Earth-centered consciousness. We talk about our lives as going back in as far as reincarnation goes. I read a lot about people reflecting back on their lives, and they're talking about Earth. And, you know, if the universe is an infinite place and there's, you know, billions of other planets with other life forms, then you would think that people would remember lives on other planets. Have you ever encountered that?
Well, nobody I interviewed, although I've read these accounts, nobody I interviewed talked about that, but I myself have had a couple glimpses of that.
Oh.
I wasn't very nice. I wasn't a very nice person.
Oh, tell me all about it. Even if you're not nice, I want to hear about it.
Well, I guess I can just tell it. I had difficulties in relationships, and I wanted to know why. So I wanted to get a past life regression, and I arranged for that, although I had never, nobody had ever been able to hypnotize me before. So I thought, well, let's just try. So I went to this suburban neighborhood, and the hypnotist had a little garden, you know, with some blue globes and things out there, and I sat out there. Again, it's just a suburban neighborhood, and I heard bagpipes, and the guy was practicing, and I guess it's traditional for them to end with Amazing Grace. I don't know, but she, they finished up with Amazing Grace. There may be, you know, maybe 10 blocks down, but you can hear it. And just as they finished Amazing Grace, the previous client walks out. It's time for my appointment, and I go in. So I said, it must be nice to have a bagpiper in the neighborhood. She says, I've never heard bagpipes here. So I said, oh, that's interesting, you know. So that was like a one-time shot, apparently. Maybe he was visiting from out of town or something. Who knows? But anyway, so I start the regression, and I start to go under, and I can feel what I would call the Holy Spirit or God's presence somehow enveloping me. And I remember, I think the first thing was an American Indian life, and I was in some kind of position of authority, but then all I get is glimpses anyway. The way I'm built, I don't go completely under and walk around in these things like some people report. I just get flashes. So I had a flash of American Indian, and then I had a flash of something else. And I was in a civilized, in a advanced civilization, but it wasn't, as far as I know, it wasn't Earth. Either it wasn't Earth or it was Earth, you know, way before, you know, that we've lost track of. So what I see is a box about the size of a one-car garage. And it's black, and it's made out of kind of a soapy material. I've seen a kind of plastic that looks like this. It's kind of a, it looks almost like oil and water, and kind of, but black, you know?
Okay.
And I know that it's a pain chamber. I know that you put people in there to experience pain. It's like a punishment chamber. And I know that I put people in there. And then I know that I had a partner, a wife, or a partner who I lost, and that I've kind of gone crazy as a result. And that I want, my only relief from my grief is to make other people experience that pain with me. So, you know, misery loves company, right? So what I'm doing, all in a flash, just a less than a second, I get the whole thing, right, as to who I was and why I was and what I was doing in this flash. So what I would do was I would arrange for couples to be separated, but I would pretend like it was just fate or circumstances, and I would pretend to be sorry for them, and I would pretend to sympathize with them, you know, but all the while I was getting off on it sadistically. And then I got the hit. I got the realization that the pain I was experiencing in my relationships in this life, rejections I experienced, which seemed sadistic to me, they were the exact emotional inverse of the sadism that I had enjoyed in that lifetime. But this was not in any recorded history. This was some other previous civilization with their own technology. So
you had got that sense that you got the sense that the technology was not of today, it was beyond that.
Oh yeah, it was a structure. You'd walk into this iridescent structure, and then it would give people pain. We don't have anything like that. We never had anything like that, you know. So then I had another one, and it's interesting how these things tie in. I had another one, and there was, I don't know where this was. I don't think it was Earth. Pretty sure this was not Earth. There was two classes of society. There was the kind of overlords, and there was slaves. Okay, and I was one of the overlord-type people, and my job was to supervise these slaves. And specifically, I was supervising a kind of a subway system that was built on the pneumatic tube principle. So it was a translucent, it wasn't a hard material. This was like a flexible material or like a living material almost that was clear. And this little canister or compartment would come shooting through this thing, and I was kind of watching it. But I was very business, all business, you know, no compassion. And what I realized later on was that these people who were the workers, they were the spiritual people, you know, who were suffering under these overlords, you know. So, you know, imagination, I don't know. But these things, it came like a flash. But the thing is that Matthew Franklin Whittier fought against slavery. He was an abolitionist.
So that makes another connection.
I think that made another connection, that he was paying back that karma by being an abolitionist and fighting slavery with everything he had.
So you were a big meanie.
Yeah, yeah. Wherever that was, it was a long, we're talking a long, long time ago, because there's a lot of life, I'd like to think so. But yeah, I was by the book, you know, no compassion, no, you know. And I just, I experienced another one, another bad one like that under Roger Wilder, you know, where I had power and I, you know.
Abused just, it.
Abused it, yeah. See, so I've got, apparently, it seems that that theme seems to keep coming up.
Yeah, the general, I think one of the outlooks on reincarnation for people who haven't done, say, an in-depth study of it, is that, you know, everybody, and you can find this at, you know, New Age centers and stuff like that, that you have the people being regressed into a past life in en masse, like a room full of people, and you'll have 8 Cleopatras and 6 Napoleons and, you know, that sort of a thing. But that's not really the depth of the research, is it?
No, and if you read, for example, I always tell people that have that argument to read Roger Wilder's book, Other Lives, Other Selves. It's not for people with weak stomachs, because the lifetimes that come up, of course, these people are in therapy, but the lifetimes that come up are lifetimes where they either did horrible things or horrible things were done to them, you know, and once they get through that, their symptoms are relieved. The phobia that they've had all their life that nobody can touch is relieved within 2 or 3 sessions with this kind of therapy. You know, it's amazing because they've gotten to the root of the thing. See?
Yeah, so, I was saying that's like, that's an unresearched opinion of reincarnation, is that, you know, everybody's Cleopatra and Napoleon.
It's a good way to dismiss it. And I think that it was bantered about in days before past life therapy really became more common, because now we've got plenty of data to show that that's just simply not the case, but that idea persists for some reason. I find it on my website. I don't, you know, there's just like the idea that you reincarnate back into animals, which is, for all my research from credible sources, is not true, but the idea seems to persist.
Okay. Well, isn't some of that part of some of the Eastern philosophies that you know, you start out as plant life and you move up through the animal kingdom and then eventually get the consciousness evolved enough to be human?
That's correct, but you don't go back. You don't go back to being a bug next time.
Right, okay. So it's a one-way progression thing.
One-way progression, except, you know, if you go to Hinduism and you're talking, you know, people that are, you know, ignorant people that don't really understand it very well. I hate to say that, but, you know, people who don't understand it very well, the rank and file, they may believe that. But people who've really studied it deeply, they understand that, you know, no, there's a progression all the way up, but you don't go backwards.
Okay. Tom, do you have a question?
Sorry, yeah. Is there a time cycle in between lives?
How do you mean? I'm not sure.
That's sort of like standard, or is there like just...
Oh, I see what you mean. Is that how long you stay up there? It's variable. It depends on a lot of factors, apparently. I have heard that if people die suddenly, you know, there's a, like unexpectedly, there's a tendency for them to come back fairly quickly. There's certain kind of guidelines. I think people may have a certain amount of choice themselves. They may want to come back in to be with certain people. Carol Bowman's second book, called Return from Heaven, is very interesting because she documents and proves, I mean, this is not speculation, she proves that there are quite a number of cases where people have reincarnated back into their families, you know, say as their grandfather or something like that. And that little kid will be sitting around and they'll get out the family album that the child has never looked at, and he'll start pointing and naming people that he's never heard of. You know, so it's pretty amazing. But that, so that, you know, you might come back sooner to be with somebody. There's any number, but there's also people that want to stay up there as long as they possibly can. And there's also apparently people up there that don't think they'll ever come back. They believe that.
Right. Right. So there could be any number of time frames between reincarnations.
Great deal of variation from what I understand.
Okay, so between the incarnations.
From, you know, from like almost right away to thousands of years in our time.
Right. I mean, if you're going to do... Yeah, I guess it depends on what you need to do and how you need to do it. Is it persistent that people reincarnate into the same family, the same genetic line, or is it varied?
Well, it can be either one, and I don't have any way to know how common it is. Carol Bowman, I mean, she's got a lot of cases because people write to her and so on. But, you know, I don't, you'd have to ask her as to, of all the cases that she studied, how many were family cases, you know.
Yeah.
And same, if you did a perusal of Dr. Stevenson's research, Dr. Green Stevenson, looked through all his books and tallied up how many were in the same family, you could get a sense of that.
Yeah, that would
I don't really know, right?
Interesting.
Now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's open, just like anything else. It's open-ended. I don't think it's one answer or another. I think it could be many answers. Like you could reincarnate in the same family or not.
People tend to reincarnate with people that they've had past lives with, that they've developed a closeness for, that they have a connection with, and that might be in their family and it might not. Now, there's people that reincarnate in a family and there's only one person they really have a connection with. You know, that's very common. Or people will reincarnate in a family and say, I don't feel like I even belong in this family.
Right.
You know, they don't know anybody. It might
could,
be somebody
it could
else.
It could be a soul group thing.
Can be. Now, on the other extreme, you have whole families who are all connected and like a soul group. Yeah, that's the other extreme.
Yeah, I mean, you may not...
A very close family.
Right, or, and the other example, meaning you grow up in a family and you don't feel like you're part of that family, you know what I mean? You're part of the family, but you just don't have any identifications or share the same interests as the rest of the family. And then you meet someone when you're like in your early 20s or something from overseas, and you strike an immediate knowing of that person. Matter of fact, your meeting is otherworldly. It hits you like a brick in the side of the head, and you may have more of a connection with them than you did with your family.
Exactly, and that may be why you incarnated, for that person, not for your family.
Right, they just happen to be the vehicle that would eventually lead you to all the circumstances that would connect you to that other person.
I also understand, for example, in World War II, there were so many people that were suddenly dying that there was a real, you know, families were at a premium, so there were people accepting just about any situation to come back, you know, even if they weren't really connected.
Right, right. There's also, they talk about there's this thing now where they talk about the star children, the crystal children, and stuff like that, and Dolores Cannon talks about this as well, about there's people that come back for specific purposes, that they've done their bit, but they're coming back for a specific purpose that involves what's happening on Earth at this time period. Have you done any research in those areas or heard of it?
I have an opinion on it. I haven't really researched it. I think it's not quite so black and white. I mean, you have to be a little careful about it. Like, this is some kind of special advanced being and this is an ordinary person. I think it's a continuum. But I think when you get to when you've had a certain number of incarnations and you've had to develop a certain amount of wisdom, that you start thinking more about, you know, like John F. Kennedy says, think not what my country can do for me, think what I can do for my country. It's like that about the world. You start thinking about what you can do for the world instead of what the world can do for you. And when you make that paradigm shift of realizing that there's something bigger than just me here, then you start incarnating purposefully, I believe, and start applying your talents, you know, okay, how can I use my talents to help other people? And you incarnate in a situation that will somehow or other bring you around to where you have opportunities to do that.
Tom, do you have a question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a kind of a crazy question to ask you. As our population is growing, right, I'm assuming there's a lot more newer souls. Am I correct?
Go finish the question, because there's a lot to this one.
Yeah. If a catastrophe were to occur where a large part of the population, you know, disappears or dies, where do all those individuals, do they go somewhere else, like in another, you know, another planet or another life cycle?
Yeah, this is a big question. So first of all, as I understand it, this has been going on a very, very, very long time. This isn't even the first planet, physical planet, that's been used as what we might call the Earth. You know, this goes on so long that it predates the physical Earth. There's also other planets that people can incarnate on. But this process has been going on so long that there are, as I understand it, many, many more people in the astral realm than there are on the Earth, and have been for a long time. The astral realm is much, much bigger than the Earth is. So when people incarnate on the Earth, you're drawing from this huge number in the astral realm. And so there's, you know, there's enough to jam the Earth, every square inch of the Earth, or there's, or it can be only a few at different eras. So the population question that's brought up is answered that way, I think, that, that at any given time in our history, there's been enough souls to jam the whole Earth if there was a situation for them. You know, it's not explained by the fact that the new ones added. So then if there's a big catastrophe, they all go to the astral realm back again. And they, and from there, they can either go on the Earth, or they can go to other planets, or, you know, if the whole Earth were destroyed, another Earth would become the focal point. So the whole thing is vaster than we can really comprehend.
It comes down, as far as the Earth-centered outlook, it comes down to available bodies.
Right, yeah. Available bodies that will give you approximately the lessons that you need to learn.
Right. I remember, I keep remembering a line from a movie. I can't remember the name of the movie, but the guy, it was in the future, and they were traveling in a spaceship, and they said, well, we got to go to Earth to resupply. And the one character said, Earth, what a shithole. So in reference to that, I would think, and if it was me personally on the other side, and I probably wouldn't think this from a, you know, from being on the other side point of view, but where I am now, I would think, man, what am I thinking? Or can I go back and change the contract? I wasn't thinking clearly when I chose to be here. There's other places that are not, you know, monkeys with guns killing each other. You know what I mean? It's like Earth can be a pretty nasty place, lower vibratory place, but, I don't know why anybody would choose to come here.
Well, this is the premier school. This is the place where everything balances and you're put to the test. This is the place where you find out what you're really made of. So if you think of it as a sport, you know, I mean, this is the place you really want to test yourself and where you're really going to grow.
Right, but couldn't I do that on another planet where? Where we just hang out on the beach and drink margaritas and don't have this thing called the monetary system?
look, take a guy that does that all their life and then see how mature he is, you know? I mean, see what he's learned. See what wisdom he's gained from doing that, you know?
Okay, there's that.
Yeah.
But there's guys who live in caves meditating 24 hours a day.
Well, yeah, if it's all internal, but that person is struggling internally. See, they've moved to a place where they're not struggling with the physical environment, but they're struggling plenty inside.
Okay, that's a good answer. I just, you know, I sometimes think, oh, it's just too much here.
Well, they call it the Veil of Tears, and they also call it the Proving Ground. So you can look at it either way, you know.
Right. Okay. It's going to be a hard assignment, but you pretty much have to do it for your own growth.
That's pretty much it. And you know, here goes nothing, I think, is the attitude of people in the astral plane. They, you know, up there you can work and work and work on yourselves and you know, for long periods of time and not really grow anything like you could do in a 20-year lifespan here. If you can figure out what you're doing here and apply yourself, that's the whole trick. The trick is to come here and realize that you're a spiritual being having a physical experience. Figure out why you're here, and then start, and then get to work. You know, if you can do that, you're gold. The problem is people come down here and forget, and they just start, you know, trying to make this the focal point.
Going with the program.
Yeah, if you can remember why you're here and start putting it into practice, you're gold.
Right, but that does seem to be, and I may just be coming at this from the wrong angle, but that does seem to be predominant. People just sort of zombieing through life and, you know.
That's why it takes so many incarnations to get anywhere, because one incarnation for most people is hard to learn anything. You know, they just, like you say, they just sort of, you know, move along through it the best they can. You know, when they get out, they realize they really didn't take advantage. It's an incredible opportunity that people don't take advantage of, basically, each incarnation.
Yeah, I'm wondering in some cases if it may be on a need-to-know basis but don't need to know, or as any other options, it could be on a need-to-know basis but you need to know, in which case, you know, you can still get stuff done in both of those cases. Like, you may not be aware of all of this esoteric information or mystical knowledge, but you sort of go through life and you achieve things in that life without even knowing you're achieving them. You know what I mean? That would be right. On a need-to-know basis, right. But don't need to know. Whereas
right.
You also may look at things and do them consciously. I know I'm supposed to do this. I may not know fully why I'm supposed to do this, but I do know I'm supposed to do this, and it's going to be good for me.
Yeah, oh, I agree. Well, part of that is intuition, and intuition is past life memory that's been consolidated and kind of crushed down and you know, concentrated to where you don't specifically remember, you just know. You have the feeling, I just don't think I want to do that again, or I just have a feeling this is probably the best way to live, and that's past life memory, but it's subconscious past life memory.
Right, that makes sense. That makes sense. And I think that things can be done both ways.
That's right. You don't have to consciously remember. You don't have to consciously know. But it does make things a lot easier on you if you understand that things are purposeful. You know, if you understand there's a purpose here and a reason you're being here, you don't fight against it quite so much.
Right. The fighting against it part might be the part that takes longer, because if you're constantly looping and doing the same thing, what's the definition of insanity again? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result?
That's right.
If you're unconscious, you may do things over and over and over again and expect a different result. Whereas if you sort of clue into it, you don't have to get the 2x4 upside of the head repeatedly over and over and over again to get you to learn a process. You'll be going, okay, I need to do this, and I'm going to do it. It's unpleasant, but it needs to be done. And then you can get through it and move on to the next experience. Maybe that's the benefit.
Yeah, I agree. Totally.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the people you interviewed. We've gone into a couple of different areas, but it's all been a very interesting discussion. Some of the people you interviewed, maybe you could talk about their stories.
Well, I one of them was particularly interesting and came about completely synchronistically. I was coming back from the Edgar Cayce Foundation and stopping at the Mayher Spiritual Center, which is the retreat connected with my group, and happened to fall into conversation with a girl who said, oh, I've had past life flashbacks. Well, a past life flashback is where something triggers this memory and you re-experience it almost in real time. And she had had three of these things. And I said, would you be willing to be, and I just had my stuff in the car, you know, so would you be willing to be interviewed? And she said, sure. So we set this thing up, and I interviewed her. And one of her experiences was intensely positive, and that's why she remembered it. And that was pretty unique, because most of the, you hear a lot about people who died some horrible death, and they have a past life memory of the trauma, and so on. But you don't, it's the intensity of the memory, the intensity of the experience that causes it to burst through the memory barrier and become conscious. It's not whether it's bad or good. So this woman had a very intensely positive experience, and it came through as a flashback. And it happened that she was eating Indian food for the first time, and when she smelled it and put it into her mouth, suddenly she flashed back to being in India, and in that flashback she was getting married, and she remembered the whole scene, and she described it to me. And first off, she was completely sincere. I didn't see any, this was not a person given to fantasy. This was a very practical, down-to-earth person. And the way she described it to me, I didn't feel that she was fantasizing or making it up or trying to please me or trying to, you know, do anything for the documentary or because she was on camera or anything like that. She just told it like she'd experienced it. And then I never talked to her again, you know. But she's not ID'd in the documentary. I want to protect people's identity, so she got absolutely nothing from it and didn't expect anything from it. So I think fraud and fantasy are not the explanations. I think it really happened.
Yeah, well, she had a lot of details in that. She was at her marriage. She was experiencing overwhelming happiness. She remembers her father being very generous and giving gifts to everybody. She also remembers a line of elephants. All done up in, you know, all the babbles and baubles and, you know, decked out, she said. And a very strong memory, it seemed to me. Very detailed.
Yeah, it was. I wanted to include that in my documentary because I wanted to show that, because I'd had Jeff Keane's memory, which was a terrible battlefield, you know, flashback. I wanted to have hers next to show that it could be intensely positive and not just intensely negative.
Right, because it's the intense emotions that are part of the...
Emotion comes through and brings these memories through.
Do you have any recollections from stories of children? And
well,
could you tell us about one of those?
Well, I interviewed a mother whose son had been telling her, as a three-year-old, had been telling her about a past life and what sounded like a... something somewhere in the Soviet bloc, I think, you know. And he had been someone fairly important. He'd had money. And by that definition, money meant that he had a car. So it was a, you know, poor area, but, you know, he was rich because he had, like, a used car. And he remembered being killed, someone jumping up from behind the back seat and throttling him.
Didn't they choke him with the wire? No.
That's right, yeah. That's what this little boy was telling his mother. And then I found, after I did the interview, I found out through the grapevine that she, the mother, had found a letter that she had written to her mother, the little boy's grandmother, in which she wrote down the first and last name. The little boy had actually given the first and last name of this person he had been. So I knew that it could have been solved. It could have been proven.
Okay. Was any follow-up done?
She would never contact me again. I tried letters. I tried phone calls. She wouldn't have anything to do with me after that. Fortunately, I had her sign a model release, but I never put her name on there. I didn't want to expose her identity, but she wouldn't have anything to do with me, and I can only speculate as to why, but she clammed up completely.
Well, I guess when people are... it's funny. On a one-to-one basis, people are very open about things like this. And I've found this before when I've mentioned to people, just in passing, that, yeah, I've done UFO investigations. I've done some field work where I've had to interview people and take down their stories. And Tom's done hundreds of those. And I don't know, maybe you found this as well, Tom. Once you mention something like that, people go, oh, he's okay. And they start telling you stuff. Tom, do you agree with that? As soon as they find out that
very
you're okay
so.
To talk to, then boom, out it comes. I was on a movie set, and I just mentioned it, you know, out of passing. I think there was somebody had mentioned something, and I jumped in and said something. And the woman behind me goes, "Oh, I've seen a UFO several times," and started to just tell me her, like, very excitedly telling me her story. And this is what I think happens, is that once people find out you're okay to talk to, that the stuff comes out. And I think we've talked about this as well, Stephen, that you've encountered this as well.
Well, it's interesting because I tell people, I challenge them and say, talk to your circle of friends and your circle of acquaintances, and I bet you you'll find somebody whose child has mentioned a past life. You know, it's that close. And I, as you were just telling this story, I was thinking, if a woman behind you can have a story, what does that say about the percentage of people in the population who have seen UFOs? Unless that was a weird coincidence where the one person in the country who'd seen a UFO just happened to be sitting behind you, my guess is it means that a vast number of people have.
No, this happens, Tom. Sure. It happens all the time, right? As soon as people find out, man, they're running up to you. Running up to you. Hey, they'll start out with a small talk and then get into it.
Yeah, the problem is that I think, you know, most of these subjects are still taboo, you know, even though it's opening up in the last few years. But generally, it's still considered taboo, and they don't come out until you know, they feel some kind of comfort or somebody is kind of opened up to them, and, you know, that's when they come out. But I would say probably a large part of the population would have probably had some kind of unusual, you know, circumstance at one point or another.
I think they're taboo, and I think there's also potential repercussions. For example, this woman may have really been pretty smart because her child could get teased at school if he was ID'd, you know. And
right,
I know my
exactly.
sister doesn't want to be identified because you can get, you know, you can get forced out of your job, and they wouldn't tell you why they're letting you go instead of the person next to you, you know. But I think there can be repercussions. And so it's something to be aware of. There's a guy that contacted me fairly recently who had quite a number of flashbacks when he was a child of being this particular person in the South, and very specific. And he really has a lot of proof. And he's writing a book, and I told him, you know, he's got a family, and he's not ready for retirement. And I said, think about using a pseudonym. And for now, I interviewed him. I took him to the place where he'd had, you know, where he'd lived in the past life and interviewed him. And I've got the audio interview on my website in the interviews page. But I didn't identify him because I said, let's just wait, you know, and see, you know, if you want to use a pseudonym or how much you want to risk, you know, identifying yourself. But it's a wonderful case. But it's a concern. If you're not retired or independently wealthy, it's a concern.
I agree completely. And this isn't just the reincarnation subject. This covers so many different areas of the paranormal, of UFOs, of people just close up and they don't talk about it. And I hate to say it, but in a lot of cases, they're right to do so.
Yeah, who am I to tell somebody they should risk their job? You know, and risk being ridiculed for this. I can't tell them.
Right. I mean, they don't talk to their family about it. And when they have brought it up, they got closed down. They went, okay, that door's closed. And they figure out real quick who they can talk to and who they can't talk to. And you're taking an awful leap when you do come out. Because, man, it's a world out there that'll crush you. It'll crush your dreams and your hopes. And any sort of, now this isn't across the board, because I've had to listen to all kinds of stories over time, over the last 25 years. And I'm just glad they're telling me the story. I'm, you know, more power to them, because they need that, because they've gotten so much dumped on them from telling the story in the past. Who am I?
Somebody who'll listen.
Right. I just need to be that one guy that listens to them. And a lot of the times it's very, what's the word I'm looking for? It's cleansing in a way. It's, you know, it's therapeutic.
Well, one of the main reasons I did my documentary was I want everybody to know that everybody else is having these experiences. You know, if they see other people telling these experiences in the film, you know, then they'll think, well, I'm not alone. Otherwise, everybody feels like they're probably isolated.
And all alone. In other countries, they're more open to the concept of reincarnation. Oh, that's one question I wanted to ask you. I want to say, is there a difference between the acceptance of reincarnation between the East and the West? Or is that just an odd perception?
Well, I don't really know. I'm not speaking from knowledge here, but my impression is that in the East, it's accepted. But whether everybody really understands it properly is another matter, or whether everybody really believes it or not is another matter, but it's socially acceptable. It's kind of like there was a day when it was acceptable to be prejudiced, and now it's not acceptable to be prejudiced. But have the numbers really changed? I don't know. So, you know, whether the percentage of people that really believe it over there in the East is that different from here, I can't tell, because what you see change is the surface expectation. What's okay, what's acceptable, what's okay to believe, what everybody supposedly believes is different in the East than it is in the West. But what each individual, because, you know, right here there's people that go to church, but they don't really believe it.
Right. So the social consciousness,
Yeah, so what you're officially supposed to believe and what you actually believe and also how much, with what depth you understand it, may not be that different between the East and the West. I don't really know, but I'm wondering.
Yeah, it just strikes me as different, interesting because of the cultural differences as well as the social expectations. You may very easily, there was an experiment done, I can't remember the name of the experiment, that a bunch of people were put in a room, and then there was only one actual participant, the rest of the people were actors, and they were shown different lines on a page, and they had to match them up. One matched with two, or one matched with four, or one matched with eight. And all the other actors would give the wrong response. They would lie.
Yeah.
And the one actual participant would, he'd start out defiant, you know, well, you're all wrong, it's two, not four. But eventually what would happen is it would wear, the social consciousness or the social expectation would wear down on him. And he stopped giving them odd looks and, you know, shaking his head, and then start complying and giving the same answer as everybody else. That's a social experiment, social psychological experiment that shows that we'll conform, and it doesn't take much.
And really start, and not only would he conform just to avoid trouble, but he would start doubting himself. Well, maybe, you know, maybe my eyes are funny or something.
Yeah, maybe they're all right and I'm wrong.
Yeah, even though I saw that UFO in my backyard, maybe I was imagining it. Maybe it was a hot air balloon. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So they'll alter their perception to line up with the perceived reality around them, the group consciousness, as it were.
I'm refusing to agree with society, you know, and not a real popular stance. So I'm basically trying to get society to come around to my side.
Have you gotten any flack from doing this? Have you gotten any bounce back, whether trying to get the DVD out to the public or the book out to the public or anything like that? Friends, relatives, stuff like that. Have you gotten any flack?
Only a couple times overtly. I think I've been turned down for a lot of jobs, and I've lost a lot of clients when I had my video production business, which I don't have officially now. But I think that my career has suffered greatly, but it's all something you can't put your finger on. It's just things that didn't happen. I didn't get hired. A client suddenly went with somebody else, you know, things like that. I got laid off from the job for, you know, no particular reason. There was one job I had where I'd been there for a year, year and a half, and all of a sudden the guys in the art department decided to Google the people's names that were working there just for fun, just to see what would come up. And I got let go not long after that. Well, if you put my full name into the Internet, last time I tried it, just like a week ago, my links are out to the 46th page and beyond.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, absolutely, guys. If you want to see the full production of In Another Life, Reincarnation in America, just type that in it, or you can put Stephen's name in and it'll pop up all over the Internet. So no difficulty finding it.
See, I went through a period where I really purposely tried to saturate the Internet. It's old. See, it's like a 13-year-old website. So, you know, and I've been writing articles. And then when I was looking for a job, I tried to get rid of it. And you can't get rid of it. It's, you know.
No, you can't. It's impossible. Once you're out there, you're out there.
Yeah. So, but overtly, I've only had a couple people. And that was when I was writing to professors all over the country and Canada, individually trying to shop my documentary to them. And I would go to psychology departments and philosophy and sociology and anything that was related, religion departments in secular universities. And I would write them, and I would put something individual in it. If there was something they were particularly into, you know, I would gear my letter to them. And I got a couple very nasty ones. One lady that says, you could send it to me only so I can have the pleasure of throwing it out. And I forget what all, you know, went on. Magical thinking, and they were pretty nasty, and I used them. I took her name off, but I put her in my on my website in the what do you call it, recommendation section, you know, where people
right. But yeah, it just goes to show you what sort of responses you're going to get from the work you're doing.
Yeah, but that's not too often. Most of the time, like for example, when I shopped my documentary around to every individually to every PBS station that I could, I got it aired on one. Everybody else turned it down. But only a few of them were really honest about why. The one from one of the southern states said, "We do not plan to air this documentary, period, boom, that's it," you know. Another guy says, "We don't broadcast pseudoscience." So they were the honest ones. You know, the right. other guy just gave some excuse, and you never know, because you can't say for sure it was prejudice. But now there was something called the Wisdom Channel, which has changed hands. Before they changed hands, they were going to, no, that's a different story. There was a PBS station out about me and wanted to be my advocate to try to get the documentary broadcast in that state. And she brought it up to her supervisor, and he said no, and she brought it up again, and he said, "Oh, I'll think about it, I'll think about it, and he kept putting her off. And that went on for a year. And she kept suggesting things like, well, if it, you know, it was done on a low budget, but we can put it in a lineup of independent films, and it would fit beautifully, you know, because they don't like to promote individual programs. That was another reason. So, and it was not a little amateurish, you know, by their standards. And she said, put it in a lineup, a series of independent films. And he didn't want to do that. Finally, a year later, she says, well, he admitted that he just doesn't believe in reincarnation, and that's why he doesn't want to broadcast it, you know. But it took a whole year for him to come around and be honest about it. Yeah. So I ran against a tremendous amount of prejudice, but usually it was covert prejudice.
Well, that's nice that you don't believe in reincarnation. What about the people that are watching the show? Are they not taken into consideration?
The people that are watching the show that are closed-minded about it get bored. They just see a bunch of talking heads. They're not interested. They're bored. They just don't believe it. In other words, they're just closed. They don't let it get to them at all. It really reaches people who either are members of the choir, you know, preaching to the choir, or my best hope is that it reaches people who are on the cusp. Well, I have a poll.
They're curious.
Those people are out there who are thinking about it.
Right. But I guess my point would be that although the guy, you know, turned you down repeatedly for various reasons, when it came right down to it, he was denying the viewership their opinions by supplanting his own as being superior to everything else. In other words, I don't like it, although I provide a service for the public. Because I don't like it means it doesn't get aired.
Well, I know. They're acting as gatekeepers for the paradigm, basically.
Right.
Don't think of PBS doing that, but they're human. And when something like that comes along, they'll be just as conservative as anybody else.
Yeah, you know, we've seen this in the UFO field as well. And I think that it's evolving. Of course, it's constantly evolving. But TV 15 years ago about UFOs, Tom, was what? Four skeptics and one guy talking about the you know?
Pretty much,
right? And all the giggling.
I think there's been a big... Yeah. There's been a big reversal on that one now. You'd be hard to find a skeptic anymore in anywhere in these fields.
Well, I mean, you've got the show Ancient Aliens.
I don't even know who. Yeah,
that's pretty deep, man.
Yeah. Because people trivialize. They say, "Well, I don't need to help that guy." He, you know, this happens in the East. The trivial version in the East is, "I don't need to help that guy. He did it to himself." You know, but that's not it. That's not a real understanding of reincarnation.
Terrence McKenna talked about this with the DMT and tribes. There's tribes and cultures that are very old cultures that have been using stuff like ayahuasca and things like that to alter, you know, brain chemistry, and they report experiences similar to near-death experience, out-of-body travel, and reincarnation. And I don't think this is a coincidence, because why do so many cultures, old cultures, and shamans and indigenous people talk about this sort of thing?
I have noticed that a lot of people seem to remember lifetimes in Egypt, you know, like as priests or priestesses or something like that. And at one point I thought, well, it's just fashionable to remember that. But then I thought to myself, I don't think that's what's going on. That's a reductionistic explanation. And if you look at it, I think what's happening is that the priests and priestesses, the religious class in that culture, practiced past life progression of some kind. They practiced opening up those memories. And as a result, it's easier for them now. So there's relatively more of those people that are having past life experiences than the rest of us. I think if you've done it in past lives, it's more likely to happen now just all by itself. Which kind of brings up the question as to all of these people that are having past life regressions now, what's going to happen when they reincarnate? You know, that barrier may be kind of, that door may be kind of loosened a little bit on its hinges for them. And is that a good thing? So there's, I don't think...
Wow, I never even thought of that.
Yeah, and very few people do. What are you doing for this guy's next life?
That never even occurred to me.
Because yeah. I do think that's what happens. It loosens the door. I used to be on a crisis hotline many, many years ago, and there was a guy, he was a Christian, fundamentalist Christian. He was seeing auras, and he didn't want to be. You know, he was flipped out about it. I don't want to be seeing this. This is of the devil or whatever. But I think what had happened is that he had learned how to see them in a previous lifetime. So now it just came to him naturally without having to try. And now he didn't want it anymore. So,
right, because his outlook was markedly different in this life and it impinged on his outlook.
So, just be careful. Be sure you want it next time as well as this time.
Yeah, this reminds me of my wife's grandmother who could see dead people from taking a line from the Sixth Sense and used to talk to them, and it made her husband get up and run out of the room a lot. But she was from a culture or family outlook that sort of, you know, they didn't look down on it, but they just sort of said, you know, you really shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And it's often made my wife wonder how much of that, how much more could she have done with that if she wasn't repressed so much? If there wasn't so many people around her saying, you know, you're freaking me out, or you really shouldn't do that, or that's of the devil, or all of these other things that they're labeling it as. That she sort of closed the door a little bit. She couldn't close it all the way because it kept happening, but she would close it most of the way. And I'm wondering if that's a prevalent thing out there.
I bet you it is. There'd be no way of, I mean, until this gets out to where people feel comfortable, I don't know how to gauge the numbers. All I can say is that if you talk about something and the person behind you has had a similar experience, that suggests that there's a lot of people out there that have had experience.
Yeah, I agree. Tom, do you have any questions? I think we're getting about 2 hours. What a great conversation.
Yeah. Actually, I want to ask, in as far as Western religions, I mean, we know the Eastern religions believe the reincarnation, but how about the Western religions? How do they look at reincarnation?
I think you have to draw a distinction between the exoteric and esoteric of the religions. In other words, the traditional religion and the mystical side of the religion. Because if you look at mystical Christianity, you see things that look a lot more like the Eastern religions, and in particular the esoteric branches of the. So there's, in other words, there's always mystics in any group. And if you want to look for things like reincarnation, you have to look at the mystical people in that group, wherever it is, and then you'll probably find it. Reincarnation was not banned in Christianity. The first time was around 300 A.D., and then again in, I think it's 535, if I remember correctly.
Well, 300 A.D., that would be the Council of Nicaea, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and then there was the Fifth Council in 535, if I remember my history correctly, that they really clamped down on it. They declared Origen, they declared his teachings anathema, and there's a whole intrigue about how that was done. It was a real tricky business, according to some historians. But anyway, it was driven out of Christianity. And you can still find little bits and pieces of it in the New Testament.
Okay. Okay, well, that's great. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Stephen. And I think I'd like to have you back in the future.
Oh, I'd love it, yeah.
I hope you get that documentary done, because it does sound very interesting. There should be somebody out there who should help you produce it and get it out to the public.
I'd like to see somebody do it. The history of this thing really needs to be told so that the frogs can start jumping.
Right. That's right. They're swimming in the hot water. They need to jump out.
They're boiling.
For sure.
Yeah, I agree. And thanks for coming on, Tom. Thanks for coming on. And we'll catch you guys next week. Oh, actually, no, wait. I want you to give out your website.
Oh, okay. It's www.ial.goldthread.com.
Okay, one more time.
Okay, www.ial.goldthread.com.
And again, the name of the DVD and the movie is In Another Life, Reincarnation in America. Everybody should search that title and watch it. It's brilliant.
Brilliant.
And thank you for your time. We'll catch you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.